Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're going to talk about the middle class on the broadcast today, how it's changing, who's still in it, and how hard it can be to get there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday. It's the 22nd of July today. And come Wednesday of this week, the President of the United States will find himself at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, to kick off what you can only call a campaign-style series of speeches about the American economy. It is, the White House says, a chance for the president to, quote, touch on the cornerstones of what it means to be middle class in America. So, as we get going today, we thought we'd do exactly that. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith on the state of America's middle earners.
The Great Recession hit the middle class hard. It reduced its ranks, income, and net worth, says Devira Cohn with the Pew Research Center.
For households in the middle, their wealth fell by 28% over the decade of the 2000s.
Pew defines the middle class according to household income and says it accounts for about half the population.
Well, certainly I look at employment.
Sherry Lincoln is a working class studies expert. Just before the housing crash, the unemployment rate was 4.6%. Now it's 7.6%. And many of the jobs being added are less attractive, says Lincoln.
Many, many people who thought that they had a solid, reliable position in the middle class, they lost their jobs. When they found new jobs, they were often paid less.
That's meant a decline in the median household income. Just before the recession, it was around $55,000. Now, it's around $51,000. Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board. He says the psychological hit of that has been as significant as the financial impact.
So there's a kind of downsizing, if you like, not only in terms of current household budgets, but also in terms of household aspirations.
Goldstein points out that consumer prices are rising at pretty much the same rate as our salaries are, so we're not getting ahead. Still, says Goldstein, the middle class might be making a comeback.
For a lot of these middle class families, the equity in their homes is their most important asset, not necessarily their 401k.
The good news is both home prices and stock prices have been rising. Still, says Goldstein, with the economy growing as slowly as it is, it might be a while before the middle class really recovers. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The first arguments in Detroit's federal bankruptcy filing are set for Wednesday. The hearing will be over retiree pensions and whether they're protected by the Michigan state constitution. Detroit, though, isn't the only post-industrial city in this country that's struggling to meet pension obligations and health care costs with a weakened tax base. So is it a sign of things to come for the rest of us? Kate Davidson has that story.
The short answer, says Jennifer Bradley, is no. She's a fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution.
I think that Detroit is actually unique in that it was a perfect storm of a lot of things that no other place has had.
Like a combination of global competition in the auto industry, years of mismanagement and political corruption, and the collapse of a tax base that had been one of the largest in the country. But a lot of cities face many of these same challenges. So how do they stave off a Detroit-style crisis? Eric Scorsoni is an economist with Michigan State University.
The diversity of the economy is critical, and it means you have industries that go up and down in different ways. And, you know, Detroit is really now just a healthcare industry. You know, the auto industry has pretty much disappeared.
So ingredient number one, economic diversity. Ingredient number two, public-private partnerships. That may sound like jargon, but it wasn't 30 years ago when Pittsburgh was staring down double-digit unemployment and the demise of its steel industry. An economic development partnership known as the Allegheny Conference helped turn the city around, leveraging the region's educational institutions to create jobs in life sciences, engineering, and other sectors. DeWitt Peart is with the Allegheny Conference.
All of this work didn't happen overnight. It has taken us 30 years to really reach a point where we feel good about where our economy is headed and what we've accomplished.
While Detroit's bankruptcy may be a unique case, a lot of old manufacturing cities hope that Pittsburgh's turnaround is not. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up all the way around, not by a whole bunch, though we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We started today with the American middle class. Who's in it and how it's changed since the financial crisis? What we didn't really talk about was how hard or easy it can be to get in to the middle class. Turns out where you're from, literally where you're from, really matters. A new study out today from Harvard University compares upward economic mobility across metropolitan areas, and it finds the economic layout of your city can have a big impact. Harvard economists Raj Chetty and Nathaniel Hendren helped write the paper. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Raj Chetty, let me start with you and ask you what might be the most obvious question out of this whole thing. Why does economic geography, as it's called, why does the layout of these cities matter so much in mobility?
That's a great question. So we started out thinking that it might have something to do with tax policies. Places with higher property tax rates, for example, might have more spending on schools, have higher rates of mobility. But we also find that many other factors seem to matter. So, for instance, some of the cities that come up lowest on our measures of economic mobility, I'm looking here at a chart, are places like Indianapolis, Atlanta, Georgia, Charlotte, North Carolina. The low-income people in the city are not living anywhere near in proximity to the higher-income people. And that can have effects through many potential channels. So take, for example, the quality of schools. If you're living in an area with several affluent people as well as lower-income people, it's conceivable that the quality of schools might remain quite high. Whereas if the lower-income people are completely segregated, it's plausible that the quality of the schools is just not as high in low-income areas because of a lack of funding, and that might set people back.
So, Nate Hendren, let me pick up from that. And if you look at a map of this study that was in the Times, the article by David Leonhardt today, the less mobile areas are clustered predominantly in the South. Was that a surprise to you?
Absolutely, yeah. When we, as Raj said, when we looked at the map, this was something that we had no idea, because it's not just about differences in income across areas. This is about taking people who are born to parents who make $30,000 a year and asking how do their economic incomes vary across areas. And, I think we have a sense that it's harder to going to rise up in the income distribution if you're at if your parents are poor, earning below $30,000 or so. But I don't think we had a sense that the extent to which you rise out of poverty varied so much across these areas.
Raj Chetty, this is fundamentally a depressing study, right? It in essence says poor kids are more likely to stay poor as they grow, and upper and middle class kids have a better chance of success.
I actually had quite the contrary take. This study made me very hopeful in the sense that there are actually places in the U.S. where kids from low-income families are quite successful with relatively high probabilities. Take places like Salt Lake City, Utah, where if you're born in the lowest part of the income distribution, there's still a 12% chance that you're going to reach the top of the income distribution, not that far away from the probability that a child from a more affluent family would have reached that same level of success.
So if I'm a low to lower middle class income earner and I look at this map, should I just pack my bags and go to one of these places that's in blue, like basically the whole state of North Dakota, because my chances are better?
Well, I think that's a really good question. That's actually something that Raj and I are trying to look into. And I think at this point, it's far too preliminary to really give you a definite answer on that. But, it's important to kind of step back and say, what we're doing here is really trying to give a picture of what mobility looks like and then try to understand how does that relate to different policies that policymakers can pursue. And I think, what we hope is that this is a first step in the direction of really understanding what people can do. And I think we'd be hard-pressed to say that we've answered the question of what should be done.
Raj, for all the detail that is in this study and in the maps today that were in the New York Times, it does seem that upward economic mobility in this country is still incredibly constrained.
People often debate, is the U.S. the land of opportunity? And what this study is saying is maybe that's not the right question to ask. There are some places in America that are lands of opportunity where kids from low-income families do have a chance to do well. And there are other places where that's far, far from the case. And I would agree with your reading that overall, levels of upward income mobility would ideally be higher than they currently are in the U.S. And hopefully by documenting and understanding this variation, we're going to figure out just what we can do to improve the prospects of low-income kids.
Raj Chetty and Nathaniel Hendren, economists at Harvard University, a new study they're doing on income and upward mobility in this country. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
No matter where you come down on health care reform, it's going to affect us all one way or another. One of the more likely ways is that you could find your employer getting on you a bit more about losing weight or quitting smoking. Not directly, but through wellness programs that come with financial incentives and punishments. Under the new law, both those punishments and the payments can now get bigger. And that leads us to this story from Penn State, where employees of that university are about to find themselves facing a pretty stiff surcharge for not going along. Shannon Mullen has more.
Pretty soon, Penn State employees and their spouses will have to fill out online wellness profiles and get physicals. They'll also need a bunch of tests, including a body mass index and blood pressure, or else. The else in this case is a $100 monthly surcharge. Brent Yurnal is chairman of Penn State's Faculty Senate, and he's on vacation.
There are a few faculty members, and it might be more than a few, I can't tell, who are upset.
The university announced the policy this month while a lot of its staff is away. Penn State says the confidential screening results won't raise premiums, and they're used for people's own awareness and, quote, wellness promotion. Harvard Health Economics Professor Catherine Baker says it's too early to tell whether wellness programs pay off.
We'll find out the answer better as more employers experiment with these programs and we see what happens to the participants' weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, etc.
A recent RAND study found only modest cost savings from wellness programs over time. Independent health and wellness consultant Vic Khanna says employers should be focused on recruitment and retention, not employees' bad habits.
A well-done workplace wellness program should be about what an employer can do with and for the employees in the workplace, not what it can do to them.
Penn State employees in the Teamsters Union won't be affected by the new policy. For those who don't comply, the surcharge hits their paychecks starting in January. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Apologies in advance for what I'm about to do. That is, break my word to you, our listeners. I didn't want to, but the crassness of corporate America obliges me to. So, that baby was born in London today. Yay. And all that. But come now, the marketing pitches from Pizza Hut on Twitter this afternoon, quote, introducing our very own royal hashtag bundle of joy, free side or dessert with any medium or large pizza. And it gives a promotion code from Oreo, quote, long live the cream. Play-Doh got in on the action, too. The milk mustache people, if you can believe that, clearly they have no shame. We've got a running list of the worst baby piggybackers at our blog. It's called By the Numbers, and it's on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
For baseball, it's the worst stadium in the league.
It's batter up for the Oakland A's, but where? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials inched up a single point today. We'll call that flat. It's 0.01% if you're really curious. Closed at 15,545, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ added 12 points, about a third percent, finished at 3,600 on the nose. The S&P 500 put on 3 points, 0.2%, ended at 1695. McDonald's sliced off 2.75% today, saying it would be, quote, challenged throughout the remainder of the year, mainly due to slow sales in Europe. Halliburton unplugged 1.75% today despite beating earnings expectations. Microsoft rebounded nearly 2% after a dismal earnings report sent Bill Gates' company down 11% on Friday. And yes, I know Bill Gates doesn't really run that company anymore. Apple powered up 0.33% a day ahead of its earnings report. Citigroup up 1.25%. Bank of America and Goldman Sachs pocketed 1.1% apiece. J.P. Morgan Chase ticked up about 0.7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Budget Committee examines the impact of sequestration on national security and the economy. NCAA basketball champs, the Louisville Cardinals, visit the White House. And Apple is scheduled to report quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Michael Dell wants to buy his computer company back. Sadly, Dell shareholders don't seem too excited about that proposition. They were supposed to vote last week on a $24.5 billion buyout offer from the founder and his co-investors. A lack of shareholder support, though, has forced the company to stall for time, which is unusual because stock owners usually do go for these kinds of takeover deals. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more from New York.
Dell's different because powerful activist investors are shaking things up. But generally, shareholder votes to sink deals are so rare, they're nearly unheard of.
In the past 8 years, shareholders have voted down less than 1% of takeovers.
That's Adam Kummel of research firm FactSet Shark Repellent. Now, that doesn't mean shareholders are powerless. Firms don't allow votes unless they know shareholders dig the deal. So they work hard ahead of time to figure out something stock owners will like. Ralph Walkling is founder of Drexel University's Center for Corporate Governance.
Companies make sure they have the votes before they go forward.
Dartmouth business professor Anit Sundaram says the actual voting is typically a scripted affair.
What we observe as a vote is somewhat pro forma and, just management theater, if you will.
Shareholders large and small can take part in the drama. But in reality, on the takeover stage, the tiny investors are just extras, outshined by the powerful star players.
Shareholding in the U.S., especially in large companies, is dominated by institutions, typically pension funds, money managers, hedge funds.
Companies court these giant voting blocks long before ballots are cast. These big investors tend to control around 70% of stocks. That's enough to make their voices roar. Individual investors, their votes just kind of meow. And these relative kittens don't really matter in the end. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
It's been 2.5 years or so since protests started in the Middle East. Some were successful, some weren't, some we still don't know. But what we do know is that protests aren't confined to the Middle East anymore. The BBC's Paul Mason wrote a book a couple of years ago called Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, about the political and economic protests that seem to be spreading. And we've gotten him back on the line for an update to our earlier interview. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Guy.
Last time we had you on, about a year and a half or so ago, things hadn't really kicked off quite yet. But now we've got Brazil with their riots and unrest over transit fears. Certainly we've got Turkey. You've been there, I know. Is there a common thread, you think, between what's happening in Europe and South America and all over?
I think there is a common thread, and that stating what that common thread is doesn't detract from all the local and specific things. But to me, the common thread has kind of three strands to it. One is nearly always a broken economic model or an economic model that does not serve the young. In Turkey, the cause was the park. The cause in Brazil was the transport system. But there's always a fundamental, number one, economic system doesn't serve you. And then on top of that, you've got the ability to organise using the internet and the ability to ignore propaganda because you don't watch the TV and the radio anymore. And then on top of that, you've got a kind of new kind of person. I call them the Jacobin with a laptop. The sort of revolutionary-minded person who can't see why the world should be like it is, and they've got the means to express themselves.
Do you think that if unemployment was 3.5% in all these countries and gross domestic product was growing at 5% a year, things would be different?
Well, in Brazil, GDP has been growing fast, not fast enough to satisfy everybody. Of course, in Southern Europe, that you've got absolute economic catastrophe and 50, 60% youth unemployment. Hard to get your head around that figure until you actually see it. People who stop, you know, having a driver's license because they say, well, I'm never going to have a car. What's the point of paying, you know, $50 a year, whatever, for a driver's license? The sort of hopelessness of young people. In the 18 months since we've been discussing this, I've come to the conclusion, what I call it now, it's the human spring.
Instead of the Arab Spring, right?
Well, Arab Spring, we had the you know, the Russian winter. It is something going on in people's lack of preparedness to go on accepting not just the economic crisis part of it, but regimes and government arrangements that don't allow them to express their individuality and their choices.
Where does it play out to then, Paul? Is there an end result here?
Look, you can stop these protests quite easily. You repress them. We saw it in Istanbul. You can, if you want to, drive people off the streets. I've compared it to 1848, the mid-19th century global uprising we saw. But what finished the 1848 revolutions off within 3 years was prosperity, was autocratic governments cracking down and then quickly delivering economic growth and rising living standards to a lot of ordinary people. And my fear is that until we get some kind of an economic deal that can do that, even if the energy runs out from the protests, you're not going to have a new period of stability.
Yeah. Paul Mason is the economics editor at the BBC program Newsnight. His most recent book about all of this stuff we've been talking about is called Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, the New Global Revolutions. Paul, thanks very much.
Guy, great.
Oakland A's have one of the best records in baseball. They're a game and a half in front of the American League West, and they're doing it on one of the smallest payrolls in the game, less than $70 million. Fans are bullish, but they have no idea where their team is going to be playing a couple of seasons from now. Nina Thorson explains.
Since they moved west in 1968, the A's have played at the Oakland Coliseum, a concrete stadium used for both football and baseball. Or, as one fan puts it,
this place is a dump, and I've been coming here for many of years. It's a dump.
This is Steve Tedino, who lives a few miles away. He and a buddy were in line waiting for the gates to open last Saturday.
For baseball, it's the worst stadium in the league. Today, we're sitting tonight for the game. We won't be able to see a home run going over the right field or center field wall. That's wrong. Okay? That's wrong.
Other fans have the attitude, it may be a dump, but it's our dump. But pretty much everyone agrees the Coliseum needs to be replaced in the next few years. The previous night, one of the vintage scoreboards conked out in the middle of the game. The clubhouse plumbing has been known to back up. The controversy is about where to build a new stadium. The A's owners have an option on some land 37 miles south of the Coliseum on the edge of downtown San Jose in the heart of Silicon Valley. But the owners can't move there unless Major League Baseball gives them the rights to the territory, which right now belong to the Bay Area's other ball club, the San Francisco Giants.
This is about market share. Baseball just happens to be the product that's involved in the dispute.
Larry Stone is the assessor for Santa Clara County and has been pushing for a baseball team in San Jose for decades.
The Giants don't want the A's to stay in the Bay Area, and if they can keep them in Oakland, they know that they'll have to move.
As in, move to another part of the country. Even though attendance is up this year, teams nowadays are more interested in corporate clients who will buy a big block of tickets years in advance. There are 13 Fortune 500 companies with headquarters in Silicon Valley. There are only 4 in the A's current territory. Peter Allen's a baseball fan and media strategist in San Jose.
And San Jose is a city of 1 million people. It's, you know, fastest growing city in the Bay Area. It's the only city in the Bay Area that's looking to be adding any significant housing or residence or office space or jobs in the next 10 years, and the team is ready to fully fund a stadium here. It's a really good spot in a really good city.
Oakland has plans for its own really good spot. In fact, it's proposed 2 potential sites. But as Peter Allen said, A's ownership is willing to pay for a new stadium in San Jose. They have not been willing to do that in Oakland. Back in line outside the Coliseum, Steve Dedino and his buddy, Doug Kugler, are continuing the debate.
People don't say, I got to see the Coliseum to see the A's play. A new stadium would change the fortunes of the A's, you know.
I just think they need to do it here somewhere, not in San Jose.
I agree. I would like them to do it here.
Sitting in a lawn chair a little farther down the line, Evelyn Ortiz says that Oakland breeds working-class heroes.
I think they're a team that is scrappy, that always works hard, and that they do have a strong work ethic, I think speaks to the people who come to the ballpark. I think the people who come to the ballpark work hard for their money, and they make a real conscious choice about where they're going to spend that money.
Although Ortiz lives just a few miles from the proposed San Jose ballpark, so she'd be happy either way. The A's request to relocate has been pending for more than 4 years. Last month, the city of San Jose finally lost patience and filed a lawsuit against Major League Baseball, claiming they are losing money because the league won't let them have a team. In response, MLB Commissioner Bud Selig said there will be no action until that lawsuit is resolved. In Oakland, I'm Nina Thorson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, it's the latest estimate on the cost of cybercrime to American businesses. It's from a study done by McAfee, the antivirus people. The number is $100 billion a year, which is smaller than McAfee's past estimates, but still, it's almost 1%, just about, of our gross domestic product. That is the entire size of the economy. Some context here, the cost of car crashes in 2010, also around $100 billion a year. None of this stuff is cheap, huh? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow up a single point. We'll call that one flat. The NASDAQ added 12 points, about a third of 1%. The S&P 500 put on 3 points, two-tenths of 1%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.